What was the world's first empire? Many historians consider it the Kingdom of Assyria, which at its peak in the 7th century BCE, stretched from the Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf. Now, Eckhart Fromm tells the story of this influential culture in the new book, Assyria, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Empire. Eckhart teaches at Yale and is considered one of the world's leading authorities on Assyria. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
My name is Eckhart Fromm. I'm a professor of ancient Near Eastern languages and civilizations at Yale, and the author of the book, Assyria, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Empire. An ancient state, originally centered in the northeastern part of the modern Republic of Iraq, Assyria later expanded into western Iran, the Levant, and eventually, during its imperial phase, even Egypt. It flourished from the 3rd millennium to the late 7th century BCE. For a long time, all that was known about Assyria came from the Hebrew Bible and the writings of Greek and Roman historians. But since the mid-19th century, excavations in ancient cities such as Nineveh, opposite modern Mosul, Karlach, and Ashur, have enabled modern historians to study the ancient Assyrians more immediately. Their art and architecture, but also, thanks to tens of thousands of newly deciphered cuneiform tablets, their history and intellectual culture. A book about ancient history may not seem the best place to look for the next big idea, which is the express purpose of this book club. But I would contend that history, even ancient history, sometimes perhaps ancient history in particular, does illuminate the present. In fact, without the ability to compare the present to the past, any attempts to understand the particulars of our own times and to prepare for the future are bound to fail. At the same time, as the Italian philosopher and historian Benedetto Croce once famously quipped, all true history is contemporary history. Studying the past with the concerns of the present in mind, in other words, is not only legitimate, but inevitable. It cannot be denied, of course, that ancient Assyria appears in several respects quite alien to the modern spectator. When making decisions, we no longer place faith in liver omens as Assyria's kings did. Most of us do not share the Assyrian taste for locusts. And yet, looking at Assyria often means to gaze at an admittedly distorted mirror image of the present. After having morphed during the 8th century BCE into the first global state, Assyria combined imperial expropriation with shrewd commercial pursuits, controlled far-off territories with the help of well-maintained roads and complex communication networks, and established a highly efficient system of political surveillance at home. For better or worse, all strikingly modern features. In this audio, I would like to share with you five insights derived from my book on ancient Assyria. Apart from their intrinsic interest, each of them, I believe, also has some bearing on how to understand and deal with the challenges of our own times. My first insight regards the nature of Middle Eastern history, which is often perceived as an endless sequence of despotic regimes. This Orientalist view, still widely held, goes back to Hegel, who considered the East a region characterized from the earliest times onwards by stagnation and autocratic rule. For the world spirit to blow more freely, Hegel argued, world history had to travel from east to west. Assyrian history shows that Hegel's assessment of the East is flawed. To be sure, in its final incarnation in the 8th and 7th centuries BCE, before it eventually collapsed, Assyria was a war-prone, autocratic state ruled with an iron fist by far powerful kings who would cruelly summarize their military campaigns by stating, "Before me, cities, behind me, ruins." But Assyria started its journey through the ages as something quite different. As a small city-state that worked hard to keep autocratic tendencies at bay. At the beginning of the 2nd millennium BCE, Ashur was jointly governed by three interlocking institutions, a dynasty of hereditary rulers with very limited power, aristocratic leaders chosen for a tenure of 1 year from the city's leading merchant families, and a popular assembly that decided legal matters, a system reminiscent of the mixed constitutions of Republican Rome or the United States. It was only in the second half of the second millennium that Assyria turned into a territorial state ruled by all-powerful kings. In contrast to later centuries, the early Assyrian city-state was, moreover, eager not to get embroiled in any wars, relying instead for its economic welfare on long-distance trade and initiative of local entrepreneurs. Assyria's power structure, in other words, underwent major transformations over time, and its economic development defies Marxist orthodoxies. Studying Assyrian history also revealed some other surprising things. Syrian sources reveal, for instance, that, in contrast to later times, the Arab tribal states of the 8th and 7th centuries BCE were often ruled by women. What all this tells us is that essentializing the peoples and states of the Middle East and considering them innately incapable of implementing social and political change is simply wrong. My second insight, admittedly a bit tongue-in-cheek and not meant to cancel out the first, is that there are also some things that apparently never change. Among these constants of human history, perceptible in the Assyrian Empire as well as today, is that merchants, entrepreneurs, and high-ranking military officers tend to make more money than scholars and academics. Archaeological excavations in the ancient city of Durkat-Limo have revealed that the house of Shalmashari, a powerful general and confidant of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal, was lavish, comprised 82 rooms grouped around 5 large courtyards. The house of Duryashur, a successful wine merchant who raised money from small investors in the city of Ashur, was relatively large as well. The residence of the Assyrian chief scribe, one of the leading intellectuals of the empire, was decidedly less impressive. According to a 7th century BCE cuneiform letter from Nineveh, it was tiny and apparently so dingy that, I quote, even a donkey would not want to enter it. Scholars and religious experts, who had fallen out of favor with their royal patrons, faced even greater distress. Some were asked by their peers, once you have become older, who will support you? It is a question that today's graduate students in the humanities often have to field as well, whether from their parents or some annoying uncle. My third takeaway from my study of Assyrian history is that crises can have very different outcomes. The last and ultimate crisis that hit Assyria in the late 7th century BCE led to the complete collapse of the Assyrian state. But a crisis a century and a half earlier, in the mid-8th century, had exactly the opposite effect. It brought about Assyria's transformation into an actual empire. What happened in Assyria during this period, in the 760s and 750s BCE, was quite similar to what the world experienced in the course of the past few years. The kingdom was struck by a series of devastating epidemics, which decimated its population, curbed economic growth, left the Assyrian military paralyzed, and led to several internal revolts. A climate change-induced decrease in annual rainfall posed an additional threat. Assyria seemed on the verge of a complete breakdown. But the country was about to experience a dramatic turnaround instead. In 745 BCE, a new king, Tiglath-Pileser III, ascended the throne and embarked on a series of ambitious military campaigns. When the king died in the winter of 727, Assyria was more than twice as large as it had been at the beginning of his reign. How did it happen that the phoenix of empire rose from the ashes of the preceding Anni Horribilis? To find an answer to this question, one must remember that history is not governed by deterministic rules. Unless they become too massive, challenges can be met by adapting to the changes that occur. And this is exactly what Tiglath-Pileser did. Taking stock of the loss of life caused in the Assyrian heartland by several bouts of plague, and realizing that it was hard to boost crop production under increasingly unfavorable ecological conditions, the king decided to focus on the conquest and annexation of foreign lands, the extraction of their wealth for the greater good of the Assyrian center, and the deportation of hundreds of thousands of people to replenish the workforce needed to keep the state going. It was, all in all, a remarkable feat of political and demographic re-engineering. Of course, Tiglath-Pileser's way out of the crisis can hardly be considered a model for our own time. His violent campaigns of imperial expansion should rather be conceived of as a warning. It tells us something about the ways in which bad actors can take advantage of the disasters that tend to befall humanity. We should all be on the lookout. My fourth insight is about beauty and learning sometimes coexisting in rather unsettling ways with cruelty and sadism. The reign of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal in the mid-7th century BCE marks, in many respects, the high point of Assyrian culture. Like many other Assyrian kings, Ashurbanipal wished to rule his country as a powerful monarch and military leader. But he was also keenly interested in scholarship and poetry. As a youth, he writes in one of his inscriptions, he had learned all the skills of the antediluvian sage Adapa, had become well-read in the signs of heaven and earth, and had carefully examined cuneiform signs on stones dating from before the flood. Apparently, Ashurbanipal wanted to be a true Renaissance man, or to be less anachronistic, a new Gilgamesh. Like the famous literary hero of yore, first an explorer and warrior, then a sage, he wished to combine the qualities of the conqueror with those of the philosopher king. In many respects, Ashurbanipal's reign lived up to such lofty aspirations. The king created the world's first universal library, a collection of thousands of literary and scholarly texts. He also commissioned some of the most intriguing works of ancient Near Eastern art. The bas-reliefs lining the walls of Ashurbanipal's newly built North Palace at Nineveh are beautifully crafted masterpieces. Some modern scholars have been so enthralled by Ashurbanipal's cultural contributions that they have described Ashurbanipal as an enlightened humanist. But there was also another side to the king. Ashurbanipal was a spiteful, brutal man who lived in constant need of affirmation, a populist avant la lettre who often play-acted as if on the stage rather than actually ruling his country. The king's descriptions of the fates of defeated foes are driven by a deep-felt hatred. Ashurbanipal claims, for example, that he destroyed the faces of some of his Babylonian enemies, flayed them, and chopped up their flesh. Too frightened to join his troops on military campaigns, he demonstrated particular inventiveness when it came to torturing captured enemies at home, usually before large crowds of spectators. Ashurbanipal's art, too, displays a pronounced penchant for violence. The 20th century German Jewish philosopher Walter Benjamin argued that there is no document of civilization that is not at the same time a document of barbarism. Ashurbanipal's Assyria illustrates this adage well. The fifth and final point I want to make is that imperial oppression can trigger unexpected responses. Strange things can happen in the shadow of empire and in the periphery of imperial power. Assyria left a legacy of great importance, the very idea of empire itself. But probably even more important is the legacy left by the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, two small Assyrian vassal states in the southern Levant. Here, a revolutionary new idea was born that would change the course of history forever, the concept of a monotheistic god more powerful than all earthly lords. How this idea emerged is a complicated story that unfolded over several centuries. But its beginnings can be traced to the 8th and especially the 7th centuries BCE, when Assyria ruled almost all of Western Asia. The kingdom of Judah was an Assyrian client state at the time. Like all Assyrian vassals, the Judean elites were forced to swear a long series of loyalty oaths to the Assyrian king in which they had to promise him obedience and profess their love for him. Based on what we know from other places, it is likely that the clay tablet with a copy of these oaths was put on display in the temple in Jerusalem and translated into Hebrew. But then something happened that the Assyrians had not anticipated. Rather than endorsing their status as imperial subjects, Judean priests reapplied the stipulations of the oaths to their own god and claimed that he, and not the Assyrian king, deserved unconditional loyalty, love, and respect. Parts of the biblical book of Deuteronomy document this new revolutionary theology, which drew on the Assyrian loyalty oaths while at the same time inverting them. From now on, it was Yahweh, and not the Assyrian king, who was Israel's and eventually the whole world's legitimate ruler. A group of Judean intellectuals bent on liberating their minds and, in the long term, their homeland, had thus sowed the seed of the idea of monotheism, an intellectual breakthrough that occurred far from the imperial center, but in reaction to Assyria's imperial policies. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll enjoy the book. Remember, Middle Eastern history is not unchangeable, even though some things never seem to change. Crises such as plagues or climate change can result in different outcomes. They can be harbingers of collapse, but also catalysts of something completely new. We better acknowledge, although it is somewhat unsettling, that beauty and learning can coexist with cruelty and sadism. And finally, imperial oppression sometimes triggers unexpected responses that can have enormous consequences. Assyria's history allows us to see all these things more clearly.
Thank you, Eckhart. That was Eckhart Fromm with 5 Big Ideas from Assyria, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Empire. You might also like our book bite for 4 Lost Cities, A Secret History of the Urban Age by Annalee Newitz. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.